So you've been in therapy for years. Maybe you've been in 12-step recovery for years. You've read the books, you know your attachment style, you understand your trauma, and yet you're still waiting to actually feel different. You're still stuck in the same patterns you've been stuck in for a really, really long time. And listen, if I am describing you here, no shame at all, because for a very, very long time, this was me. And then I realized that all of my healing had been from the neck up. I had never actually gotten into my body, and I learned that somatic healing, nervous system regulation, it's not optional. Like, it's not just a suggestion. It is a requirement if you actually want to heal from a dysfunctional childhood. And what do you know? Once I actually started doing that work, I finally started making headway on the patterns that I was starting to think that I was going to be stuck in for the rest of my life. And so I built a course, y'all. It is called Safe Within, and it is everything that has actually worked for me all in one 7-week life journey. It's 3 parts. In the first part, we are going to actually learn how to feel safe in our bodies through practices rooted in somatic experience. Experiencing and polyvagal theory. Then in part 2, through somatic parts work, we are going to get to know the parts of us that are keeping us stuck in places that we don't want to be stuck in. And then in part 3, this is about actually learning how to feel good as a felt experience in your body. Because let's be honest, for so many of us, good feelings are deeply uncomfortable. Calm feels unsafe, joy feels suspicious, and we're going to do something about that, okay? And here's something I want to be really honest about. One of the biggest reasons I struggle to do this work for so long is that I could not get myself to do it alone. Like every day I would tell myself, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And then what do you know, at the end of the day, I had not done X, Y, and Z. This was day after day after day, year after year after year. And so part of what I built into this intentionally is the accountability piece. We meet live, you show up. You can't just talk yourself out of it the way that you can when you're trying to do this stuff on your own. And listen, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that you're going to be perfectly healed after 7 weeks, but what I do think is that you are going to feel a hell of a lot more connected to your body. You are going to feel much safer actually being in your body, and you're going to walk away with tools that you will use for years, if not for the rest of your damn life. And I want to make this very, very clear. You do not need to have any prior experience with IFS, with parts work, somatic work to do this course. None. You can show up having never heard of any of these words before, and you will be taken care of. I will guide you through every single step. So we start July 1st. When you sign up, you also get 2 months free in the shit show with access to all of our weekly support groups and everything else that we got going on in there. So you, yes, you, yes, you, the person who knows that they need to sign up, the person who is currently in their head right now, thinking about how I need to do this course, get out of your damn head and get into your damn body. Take that little hand of yours, get on your computer or on your phone, and just sign the hell up already. Go to adultchildpodcast.com/safewithin, adultchildpodcast.com/safewithin. And if you have any questions at all, feel free to email me directly at Andrea@adultchildpodcast.com. Do it. Do it now. Sometimes the hardest bottom you'll hit has nothing to do with a substance and everything to do with another person. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shitshow. I'm also an adult child. And if you're wondering what the hell is an adult child, well, let me give you 2 definitions, okay? So the first one comes from the 12-step program, ACA, and they define adult child as someone who responds to adult situations with self-doubt, self-blame, or a sense of being wrong or inferior, all learned through childhood experiences. The second definition I'm going to hit you with comes from adult child pioneer psychotherapist Tian Dayton, who's been on the podcast many a times. And she defines an adult child as someone whose unresolved childhood pain surfaces and plays out in adulthood, and not in a good way, okay? Not in a good way. And if you're wondering whether or not you are one, well, I hate to break it to you, but I think the chances are pretty high that you are if you stumbled upon this podcast. But guess what? You're in good company here, okay? Welcome aboard this hot mess of a healing ship. We curse here. You've been warned. I promise that this is unlike any other trauma podcast you have listened to, whether or not that this is your cup of tea or not, we'll see, okay? So today, folks, we are diving deep with David Dean Haskell. So he is the author of the newly published memoir, Inner Angels. And y'all, this one is a real goodie, okay? This is just one of those conversations where we just go through his story, but he's experienced like so much shit that the conversation just naturally covers an enormous amount of ground. I didn't have to do much. The depth just came up on its own. There is something in here for everyone, let me say. Also, too, I don't know if we've ever had a guest on who lost a parent to suicide as a kid. So I'm glad, you know, for the listener who experienced that, or even just like the death of a parent at a young age. You know, I think there's a real unique, specific kind of trauma that comes from this. So, you know, for the listeners who lived through this, who experienced this, like, you deserve to hear that spoken out loud and spoken about so clearly. But what was most near and dear to my heart was the tale of David's bottoms. So he had a nice two butts like me. Y'all remember that? I feel like it's been hitting butt. Long-term listeners, you know what I'm talking about. It's been a long time since we've talked about hitting butt. The new folks are gone. They're gone. So yeah, he got sober from drugs and alcohol and life got good. Life started getting good. And then much like me, all that childhood shit started to come to the surface through a relationship. It wasn't a romantic one for him, but a relationship nonetheless. And yeah, that codependency bottom, that attachment wound bottom is no joke. Like, it really takes you to new depths of pain that you never thought were possible. Like, I never would have truly believed that, you know, hitting butt from codependency, from my childhood trauma, my abandonment wounds. I mean, it's really abandonment wounds. Hitting bottom from abandonment trauma is the fucking worst, y'all. It is brutal. And I think it's really hard to comprehend that if you haven't experienced that, or if, like, if you're not like informed. Like, I know everybody here knows what's up, but just for like the average Joe Schmo out there, I think it can be hard to comprehend how hitting bottom from codependency can be equally as painful, if not more painful, than hitting bottom from substances. And you know, it is the exact same reward circuitry in your brain. Like, a codependent relationship, if you look at fMRI studies, it shows how like the same reward circuitry in your brain that lights up for cocaine, the same dopamine pathway, lights up when you are in a codependent relationship, when you're focused on your partner, when you're caretaking, when you're trying to keep them sober. Like, your brain is not distinguishing between a hit of a drug and a hit of another person, or of being needed or wanting their approval. And, you know, the back and forth of a codependent relationship, whether it's like when they're responding to you or not responding to you, when they're sober, when they're not sober, when you're in a good place or when you're in a bad place, it is the same sort of intermittent reinforcement pattern, that dopamine and oxytocin, and then that cortisol and adrenaline. It's the same exact intermittent reinforcement pattern that makes slot machines absolutely impossible to walk away from. Like, there is a neurochemical reason that these relationships are so hard to walk away from, almost impossible, it feels like at times. Your brain is hooked. And then when the relationship finally ends, you know, or when you start to pull away or they pull away, like, you go into actual neurochemical withdrawal. Like, the intrusive thoughts, the obsession, the anxiety, the body symptoms, that is your brain detoxing from the relationship in the same exact way that you would detox from a drug. Like, that is a codependency bottom. That is an abandonment trauma butt. And it is no joke, y'all. And it's what I experienced. It's what David experienced. And it's what this
conversation is going to put to words for a lot of y'all on top of so many other experiences. So let's get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you, need to DM the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket, where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a community that pulls together a lot of different healing modalities. It takes a village to work through this stuff, right? It takes a village of modalities, and it also takes a village of people who actually get it. You know, limbic system level healing is required for us to heal from this stuff. And we experience limbic level system healing when we feel truly safe, when we feel truly seen, heard, and understood by another. And I don't think that there is anything that makes us feel that way as much as other people who experienced the same thing. Maybe it's not exactly the same story as us, but the feelings and the wounds are all the same. So you, yes, you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, how about you just do it already, okay? Yes, you looking over your shoulder right now. Damn the Join Shit Show for less than $1 a day. See the link in the show notes, or you can go to adulttribepodcast.com/shitshow next. Give me a little follow on the Insta and on the TikTok at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, 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 please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right. Well, let's rock and roll.
All right.
When did this book come out? Last year?
When did Angels come out? Yeah, March 13th, 2025, mm-hmm. which was my birthday. And nice. I'm working on a follow-up book now. Which it's actually already written, but I'm just looking at the timing and when I want to polish it. Right now, I'm working on fiction more. So this year has been more dedicated to fiction, but Wounded Angels came out, yeah, March 13th, 2025.
How long had you been working on it?
So I started writing it in the summer of 2024, and it got written really quickly. I didn't intend to write it. I wasn't even happy to be writing it because I didn't want to write nonfiction at all. Like I was like, what do I want to do this for? What do I want to tell my story for? Like this stuff that I don't want to talk about. But it got written in the middle of the work. So I was doing inner child work. I was doing all that kind of healing stuff, 12-step work and the like. And I just started feeling compelled to write it like every morning. So it got written within about 6 weeks or something. The draft. Yeah, it was quick. And then, I mean, I polished it since then and added some stuff, but the bulk of it was written in the summer of 2024 in about 6 weeks. And then I sat on it for more than 6 months because the inner child didn't want to publish it. It was like, I just wanted to throw it away, or like, you know, I didn't want anybody else to read it because there's a lot of sensitive information in there. There's a lot of the really raw moments and the moments that I felt shame, the moments that I felt inadequate or like, you know, not a part of the human race. All that stuff's in the book. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation because I was trying to think if, have I had a guest on that had a parent that committed suicide at such a young age, but we'll get there. So, David, when was the moment that you realized that your child had screwed you up more than you initially thought?
I've always known it, but I didn't necessarily admit it. I mean, okay, yeah. So my mother's death, for sure, because I always heard about that from adults and whatnot. Oh, you know, you're struggling because she died, whatever. It's like, you know, you're having behavioral issues because she died, because I was scapegoated like crazy as a kid. And only as an adult that I was in healing, was I able to look back and just be like, wait a minute, that, you know, what my dad did was not right. You know, what my stepmom did was not right. Like really not right. And it's like, well, where was their accountability? Cause it was always, you know, David did this or David did that.
I mean, more so from the perspective of like realizing that what you were going through, you know, in adulthood, like really being able to see the impact of, right. of your upbringing showing up.
Right. So, yeah. So the part about the other stuff, the stuff besides the fact that my mom died, I always downplayed a lot of that. And like, well, everybody has trouble. Everybody has problems and whatnot. and not realizing that like there was like really major traumatic stuff that happened to me that would have been like the ultimate traumatic thing for somebody else. Like, for example, my parents divorced when I was one, before she died, right? Mm-hmm. Having a, you know, and so another thing was that she, when she died, I was four, and the whole maternal side of the family disintegrated. My grandparents divorced. My grandfather disappeared. My stepfather disappeared after promising to come back and see me. My aunt disappeared and my playmate cousins. Like, so I lost like six major people. So it wasn't just like the death of a parent. It was like if you had a fire and your whole family died or something. And I never even thought about along those terms until after, you know, addressing addiction and that kind of stuff in my 40s, when I was finally just about dead and hit bottom, you know, twice, because we're talking about, you know, substance abuse bottom, but then there was also the codependency bottom, which was even harder.
More painful. No kidding.
Painful. Certainly more emotionally painful, but I think I was also kind of closer to despondency and potential suicide at that time. So yeah, the question is so broad. There was, you know, a lot of moments in my adult life that I looked back and said, oh, this was way more fucked up than I thought. And I'm sorry if we're not allowed to use
that language. No, I say in the beginning of all my episodes, we curse here, you've been warned.
Okay, good. Then I won't worry about it.
Fuck, cool. Say all the fucks you want to say.
Thank you.
So your mother, she died when you were four or five or four?
Died when I was four.
Do you have memories from that time?
From that time, yes. Of her, no. I tend to think I must have blocked some stuff.
Absolutely. Was the fact that your mother died like something that you were always aware of as a kid? Or do you remember learning that? Or was it just something that you always knew?
It was something I always knew. But the suicide part, I didn't learn until, and this was the major part of the book. The suicide part was told to me by my father when I was nine. They had kept that from me.
Do you remember that?
Oh, vividly. Because that was so that, and again, so, okay. So the way that it's laid out in the book is I had a re-traumatization 40 years later, revolving around CODA and getting mistreated by somebody that I trusted and cared about. And it wasn't the same situation at all, but the feelings that,
an emotional flashback,
shame flood and whatnot. So it was the next day after I was told, the next day I was sitting in class, there wasn't any sort of aftercare or anything. According to my parents, I sort of didn't really react and they thought I didn't care, but I had gone inward, probably dissociating and in class, and that inner child was stuck in a shame attack. It was the first time I ever felt it. And I didn't even know what it was at the time. I just thought, I feel horrible. I feel wrong. I feel, you know, what will my peers think? What will anybody think? What's wrong with me? And that all happened and sort of froze in me as like a way that I never want to feel again. You know, it's like, that's the most horrible feeling. But then I would feel it very often because I was rejected by peers. I couldn't maintain friendships. I was like, I'm not likable. I'm not like lovable. What's wrong with me? How do I fix it? I couldn't figure out how to fix it. Kids didn't like me because I was too weird or too abrasive or defensive and defiant and all that kind of shit. And I didn't really start to process that until the 40 years later, in the middle of recovery work and all that sort of stuff, inner child work. And I was, what's the word? It's not abandoned. I'm trying to think of the word. Not rejected. What's the thing when narcissists do it to you at the end? Discarded. Discarded by someone I do consider was a narcissist. And the discard gave me a complete re-traumatization. And at that point I was like, oh, that's what that was. And I was like in touch with that inner child, the 9-year-old. It's like, oh, you're having a shame attack. You feel, you know, this is outside of you. It's nothing wrong with you. But I just became really, really aware of what that what that stuff was all about. But it was a long time after that that I wrote about it.
So what were the circumstances that led to your dad sitting you down and telling you about your mom?
I had misbehaved.
At school or at home?
I don't remember, but it felt like a punishment.
Really?
So there would be these blowups, usually around my birthday, because like she died around the same week of my birthday, like a week after or something. So March was always really rough for me. And whatever happened at school or home might have been a conflict with my stepmom or conflict with bullies at the school or maybe something with the teacher. But anyway, we would go through this. It happened more than once. Where we go through, you know, the screaming and yelling and that kind of stuff. And then followed by the, oh, we love you. We just want you to be okay, blah, blah, blah. And then they would start to reveal stuff like that. I don't know what the thinking was behind it. The thing is, my dad, he passed away last year. And we spoke 2 days before he died. Like there was a lot of healing. He never got into recovery or anything like that. But, you know, he did the best he could as an adult. But as a kid, the way he handled things was just so damaging without really realizing it. Like he said stuff to me like, I'm really glad your mom didn't kill you, because a lot of people who suicide kill their kids. And so I don't know what his reasoning was to say that, but what does a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old think? It's like, okay, why did my mom hate me? Why was my mom a murderer? What, you know, what was wrong? You know, like that just made it much, much worse. Not on purpose. I know it wasn't on purpose, but it was harmful. And it's a little easier for me to talk about it now that he passed away, strangely enough, because I never wanted to visit the guy. He was always sort of following my career and whatnot. And he read the book, he read Wounded Angels. And it did hurt him. I knew that it would. But we talked about it, you know, it was hard for him to read, but you know, same thing. I have a daughter and, you know, any child of an addict or alcoholic is going to suffer. If my daughter wrote a book, I'm sure it would be very difficult for me to read.
Well, the fact that he even read it, I mean, the vast majority of our parents
wouldn't be
willing to read it or be willing to have a conversation about it afterwards. That wasn't just an attack.
He handled it really well. And it made me feel bad. It was weird. I asked him before I published it. I thought, yeah, I did a lot, you know, it's like a lot of prayer and reflection and whatnot. Like, should I even publish this? You know, I don't want to hurt people, blah, blah, blah. And I decided I needed to talk to him about it and give him the opportunity to read it ahead of time if he wanted to. And he gave his blessing at the time. He said, you know, write whatever you want and I'll read it if you want, or I won't read it if you don't want. And so, yeah, no, he handled it really well. And I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, I mean, that's so healing and so huge, because I think that for so many of us, what we want more than ever is just to have what we experienced validated. And that is, I mean, he didn't try to tell you what you experienced isn't what you experienced, to try to tell you to change it. So that's quite huge.
It was. But he did say he thought he wasn't put in a good light. But the truth is I left some stuff out too. So it's like, you know, but again,
yeah,
you know,
being put in a good light, that doesn't mean that it's not true.
Right.
Right. So obviously you said your stepfather disappeared. So your mother got remarried after your parents divorced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they divorced when I was, that was a whole other complicated, that whole family was dysfunction from day one. There was a lot of mental health issues.
What family?
My mother's, my maternal side.
Uh-huh.
My mother, my aunt was very unwell. My great grandmother was lobotomized in an asylum. There was a lot of secretive kind of like hush hush talk about that sort of thing and whatnot. And so my mom, had another kid out of wedlock that she was forced to give up to adoption.
Before she had you?
Way before me. So that's another secret that I learned about from my dad, like along the way.
In childhood?
Yeah, at some point when I misbehaved. And so she was very troubled and struggling. And then so they divorced when I was one under. Well, okay. So speaking of these different traumas, she was hospitalized right after I was born for a postpartum for like either weeks or months. I tried to confirm how long, and I, you know, my dad didn't really remember. My uncle said he would have said maybe weeks.
I mean, that's huge. That's huge trauma. That's huge. That is big T, huge trauma, being separated. That's a huge attachment trauma.
Absolutely. I don't know how I got fed at that time. So, and that's, these are things that, again, like your first question was such a mind blower, because it's like, when did I start to come to terms with these sorts of things? You know, it's been a long journey in, you know, realizing that kind of thing. That alone, as you say, thank you, was obviously must have been traumatic for me in weeks old or months old. And then, so my great grandmother that was lobotomized, was in a particular asylum in Massachusetts. And my dad unknowingly put my mother in the same asylum. And so her family went crazy and basically poisoned her against my dad. Apparently, this is only my dad's side of the story, all of this stuff, because I really didn't have, but he was as honest as possible.
Clearly.
No, that he was the kind of person that would say, he could say hurtful things and say, well, I'm just being honest. You know, it's like being hurtful or abrasive is not the same as honesty, but that's a whole other story. Right. But I didn't tend to know him as anyone who would, play with the truth. So I tend to believe what he says. And she was sort of poisoned against him. They said, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. He threw you in that hospital, whatnot. You need to divorce him. So age one, they got divorced. And then, yeah, she remarried another guy who was much younger. Yeah. And I don't know much. I have a bad vibe about that guy too. Well, I can't, nothing provable, but I'll just leave it at that. He's long since passed away, but.
Do you know what the circumstances were? Like, was there something particular that was going on when your mother took her life? Was there a trigger?
Again, these are second and third hand stories, but she had lost her job. When she was very well educated, she had a master's and she was very proud of her work.
What did she do?
Something to do with education. And so her new husband's family didn't like that they were married and had some kind of influence around the town and whatnot. And
do you know what the age difference was?
Like 10 years.
Okay.
He was like 21 and she was 31, something like that. He was very young. I remember, I thought he was so cool too. He had a motorcycle and he had
he was a big brother.
So I have memories of that and him, but no memories of my mom.
So zero memories of your mother.
Zero.
Yeah.
Nothing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that makes me sad, you know, cause I wish that I did, but anyway, yeah. So strange circumstances led to her losing her job. And I guess maybe that was a last straw kind of thing, but I don't know what was happening with her mental health wise. I know she, with me, moved several times to several different places. And then maybe a week or two before she died, they had not joint custody. My dad took me on the weekends.
Yeah. I was going to ask what the circumstances were with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But she asked him to take me and wouldn't explain why. And then he didn't really know why, but he took me, and then she did it like a week later or something like that.
Wow. And was your dad remarried at that point?
No. He remarried a couple of years later. He was dating
your stepmom.
I call Janet is her name. She's my stepmom, even though they divorced later. I think around the time I was maybe 20 or so years old, but I left home at 14. Mm-hmm. This is such a long story, right?
I love it.
But then he remarried a third time to the person who was still married to him when he passed away. I've talked to her and she's, Really nice lady. Her name's Tina. I consider her a friend, but I never, like, he wanted me to call her mom and whatnot. And like, she's fairly close to my age. And I'm not going to call her mom. I met her when I was like 25 or something like that. So it's like, yeah. So that his second wife is someone I would consider like stepmom and whatnot. She raised me from age 6 until I left the house around 14.
Yeah, I feel like the emphasis on wanting you to call her mom is like a way so that he can feel better about the age difference, right? Like if you call her mom, maybe. Then maybe it's fine.
Could be. He ended up in a nice relation. They really were good for each other, and they were together for a long time. So they were married much longer than he was married to his second wife. And but she's really. If Tina's watching this, hi Tina. You know, she's pretty devastated by his passing away. So I'm thinking of her.
Were you an only child? Well, obviously you have. Did you ever connect with that the child that your mom had out of wedlock? Ever
no,
looked
I have
into
a
it?
Brother, and I never connected with him. I gave it some thought as an adult, and then I thought, and this guy would have been like 10 years older than me, and I thought, what would I say to this person? Hey, I'm your half brother. And by the way, your mother's dead and like the family's disintegrated. I just ended up thinking, yeah. And plus there was no real viable way for me to look
figure
into
out
those records. But I do, I have a half sister. So we have the same father, and my stepmom is her mom.
Janet. And how old is she?
She's exactly 7 years younger.
Seven
than
years
me.
Younger than you. Okay.
Yeah, age 13. Yeah.
I think that there's a lot of similarities in our stories. Like I didn't leave home at 14, but that's when I got sent to rehab. I was also very much the identified patient, the scapegoat, rejected at school. Like, you know, I became the girl that nobody was allowed to be friends with or wanted to be friends with, all that stuff. So when did you start, like, do you know when you started to have like behavioral issues at school? Or at home? I mean, obviously you're just reacting to the environment that you like that you were living in, but.
Yeah. I mean, to me it was like always, but
just
maybe more like I was told that, like,
yeah,
my behavioral issues, when I look back, I got bullied a lot. I was defiant, and I would, you know, lash out verbally. But I can't say that it was necessarily my fault. Like when I look back at it, like, you know, it's okay.
Of course,
so
it's
this
not
is
your fault.
Yeah, right. Well, this is a big thing for me for adults and kids and whoever else and everybody I talk to in relationships is water seeks its own level.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe that. You see a conflict and you think, oh, this kid's being bad and this kid's whatever. Mm-hmm. Water seeks its own level. Mm-hmm. And I was a good target for bullies because I would rise up. And that, you know, that's another thing. I was having a talk with a good friend recently about this, where I would be the one that would get triggered and like, oh, you know, get all angry. And then the other person, you know, has all the power to say, oh, look, see what's wrong with you,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's like, well, wait a minute. No, look at these little microaggressions and things that person said that sort of ramped it up and ramped it up to the point where, boom, you know, David doesn't get along with these kids. But what they were saying and doing, you know, it was a rough neighborhood. It was mm-hmm. my stepmom's neighborhood. I grew up in Medford. I didn't really vibe with the kids. There was a lot of fights. It wasn't just me. And so I grew up in the 70s. I know I'm
37.
Say, quite a bit younger than me. It was the 70s and 80s, and the teachers would
in
tend
Boston,
to say,
yeah.
yeah, take it outside. Like there was no protection. There was no, like, you know, it was just like, don't fight in here. Go wait till after school. And I was terrified every fucking day. The school was a nightmare for me because I thought I was going to get the crap kicked out of me, like after school, or mm-hmm. I was threatened. It was either threatened or it was going to happen. And, you know, and then behavioral issues at home. A lot of defying my stepmom, a lot of I'm not going to do these chores. And I also had trouble with my grades. I'm an intelligent guy. I'll just, without fear, I'll say I'm an intelligent guy.
I love it. I'm an intelligent gal.
Oh, yeah. Obviously. Right. And the thing is, I never got a B. I never got a C and I never got a D. I won't say never, but basically I didn't get B's, C's, or D's.
You got A's
I
got and F's.
A's if I trusted and liked the teacher. I got F's if the teacher like rubbed me the wrong way.
That's so interesting. I've never heard that, but I bet that that's a thing. So reach out if you can relate to that. That's so interesting.
Yeah, it was a take. It was a way to take control, I guess. No, well, it was a way to reward the teachers that I was trusting too. You know, and then they were, well, we all know you're smart. So you really need to just apply yourself. But how could I focus on school? Like it was a nightmare. I didn't have any, like, people talk about the peer relationships and the fun that they had and whatnot. I didn't have that in elementary school. In junior high school, I started to get into music, which was my thing, still is my thing. I'm a drummer, professional drummer. And I got in with the drum lines and that kind of thing. And I still struggled with peer relationships, but it, you know, I was good at something. And so things got better and I wasn't getting outright bullied or, you know, threatened with violence anyway.
So what were the circumstances that led to you leaving home at 14?
Things were getting dangerous. My dad and I were taking it up to higher levels of, things were getting dangerous. And there was a point, and this is in the book, but I didn't mention his name. This is the one of the things I edited. I talked about someone's hand around my throat. Originally in the book, it said my father's hand was around my throat. I took that out. And so he, you know, he read that, but, and now I'm revealing it. That happened at least once, maybe more. It wasn't like spanking anymore, that kind of thing. It was like, you know, and again, that's another thing that, like, at the time I thought, oh, he was just angry or punishment, whatnot. But you look back, that's threatening
abuse. Yeah.
That's a threat of like, I'm going to harm you. I could harm you. I have the power to harm you.
On top of already being told that, like, you're lucky that your mom didn't kill you.
Yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah. Well, hey, you just put two things together, right? What happens inside a kid's head, right? And so, And there was, I'm trying to think, there were other factors. I was hospitalized at one point. I had tried to kill myself a couple times and they put me in a hospital and I got a friend to come and break me out of the hospital.
Wow.
I know. Right?
Well, you had a friend. That's a good friend.
I did. He was the drumming. So this was when I had already gotten into the drumming. And so I had some kind of buddies, whatever. That was another inappropriate relationship. He was like 5 years older than me. And
were you on like a psych unit?
I guess it would have. Well, I wasn't. I was only there for like an hour or two.
Okay.
So some kind of a psych unit kind of thing. And I ran away. And I stayed at his house. His mom, this was more in, you know, more like, you know, just in bad places with bad people kind of thing. I remember there was a lot of drinking at his house too. I don't remember. I think I was given alcohol too, or I might've just taken it. And that would have been aged around 13 or 14. So I stayed out of the house for 2 or 3 weeks. And then finally, I think that his mom got sick of having me or something. You need to call your parents. And I called them. And so, and I look back and they went through a lot. Cause like, I can't imagine, I have a daughter. And if she disappeared when she was 14, because actually when she was 14 was right when I was, you know, at my rock bottom. And, you know, thankfully she didn't do any of that, but, so it must've been really hard for them, but, and hard for me too. And it was like, I ran away more often, you know, I was just running away all the time. And then, I just desperately had to find someplace else to be. And my mother's mother agreed to take me in. So I spent high school living with her.
And how was that?
Better. Better. Yeah. It was calmer, you know, and then, but you know, I still had, I mean, that was, it was decades before I actually started even addressing a lot of that shit. You know, high school was, you know, calmer, but still not normal. I didn't like have good relationships or strong relationships or anything like that. I was doing a lot of drumming. And as I said, I ended up flunking out of high school. Oh, I don't know if this is when we were chatting before the recording, but I flunked out of, not flunked out of, I quit junior high. I quit junior high. That was related to all that going on. Like I was leaving the house. Then I quit high school just because I didn't want to, I just couldn't stand it. But I ended up going back and finishing because I didn't want to work at McDonald's anymore. And then I ended up dropping out of college as well. And that was mostly due to alcohol taking hold on me and the music was falling away. Like I was a world-class drummer in one of the best groups in the world when I was 19. And then I went to college after that in a music program, and things were going well for a while, but still, like, you know, that's when, you know, addiction started to take hold. I didn't have any support, couldn't hold down a job or make money and that kind of thing. So, you know, things were kind of looked like they were looking up at times, but they never really were.
Like, what age did substances really become a big issue for you?
A bit late, middle of college, like 19, 20. I drank before that. I never got much into drugs because I wasn't cool enough to chill with the drug dealers. Like I would have done a lot more drugs if I could have, because like, you know, I wasn't cool enough. And I was always like, you know, if I went to buy some pot or something, I'd be like kind of a weirdo and like wanting to get it and get out. I didn't want to hang out and chat with them and get high. So nobody trusted me or liked me to give me drugs, but you know, the bartender will always give you a beer. So
it's very true.
Going that direction. But yeah, college, 19, 20, 21 years old. Yeah.
That's when I got sober. I got sober at 19. Yeah.
I would say another thing about my dad, and this is not, you know, slam on the guy necessarily, but
you don't have to use that. We all know here.
He gave me alcohol as well when I was younger. So it was, I don't know how old, 11, 12, 13, that kind of thing. Oh, have a sip of beer, have some beer. So, you know, that's not the kind of thing that is appropriate. Yeah. So.
Clearly. how do you think your grandmother was impacted by your mother's death?
Oh, devastated. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole family was devastated, obviously. I don't know that, again, the sad thing about my mom's side, nobody ever talked about anything. Mm-hmm. And so we never really talked about it at all. My aunt, who was very unwell, we never talked about her. She was a schizophrenic and disappeared at times. And we were worried about her, but it was always very hush hush. Like, where is she? What's, you know, hope she's okay. My uncle, who we lived in the same house in Braintree, Mass, a split house, you know, my grandmother and me on one side, my uncle and his family on the other, is, you know, my mother's brother, never once mentioned her name to me. Not once. Never once said, yeah, let me tell you a story about your mom, or, you know, that kind of, you know, when I look back at that, it's like so sad that whole family's just, I have one cousin who I connect with from time to time. She might watch this podcast. And we've talked about being survivors of that family. And I swear that's like, it's just she and I. We had another beloved cousin who died at 29 of alcohol. He choked on his vomit and died. Could have been me. That could have been me so easily. I have a little bit of survivor's guilt about that, thinking about Danny. Trying to think who else. There's some family in Florida, that one uncle who sort of, you know, got away from all that. But yeah, just a really tragic story.
Just a really healthy family.
That family's gone. It was so unhealthy, it disintegrated, which is sad to say. I talked to my daughter about it a bit. She's been to her grandmother's grave in America many times. She's half Japanese. And, you know, you think about suicide, and I think, what a shame she never knew that she would have a granddaughter one day that she might, you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. really sad when that happens. I think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you you hit your alcoholism bottom while you were in Japan.
Yeah.
You know, I actually picked up my 9-month chip at a meeting in Japan, in Tokyo.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Nice. I went to an English speaking meeting. Yeah.
When, how long ago was that? You said you got sober.
That was in, I got sober in 2008. So that was in 2009.
All right. I was here.
Mm-hmm. Drinking.
Not sober. the funny thing about that. So as I said, I things really ramped up and I dropped out of college. And I ended up in rehab. And that was 1995. And I remember that because of it was the Oklahoma City bombing.
Mm-hmm.
Was going on when I was in the rehab. And at the time, I wasn't
ready.
Done, mm-hmm. You know, and they threw me in there. It's like, what, you know, so what? I dropped out of college and tried to kill myself. What the hell? Why would you want me to quit drinking or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
So at that time I was introduced to 12 step and whatnot. And I went to meetings. I think I was like clean and sober for like a year. But not remotely ready. But then, so there was that. And then I got to Japan for the first time.
What brought you there?
Disney. I played drums on trash cans at Tokyo Disneyland.
Wow.
That's what brought me to Japan. So that was 1998, right? Yeah. So this was still like, I had some real success along the way early on, but you know, I was so plagued by, you know, trauma and addiction. Mm-hmm. It was never going to last. Mm-hmm. But so 95, I was in a rehab. 96, I moved to Florida. 97, I was doing well in Florida. I worked at Universal Studios and Disney. But I was really going downhill fast and probably would have died if I'd stuck around for much longer. 1998, I ended up in Japan. So it was only 3 years later. And at that time, I was like, oh my God, if I can't stop drinking, I'm screwed. I'm, you know, everything's already falling apart. I've got this Disney job, but I'm, you know, hungover every day and everybody hates me because I'm an asshole. And so I called my sponsor it was NA,
mm-hmm.
From New Hampshire from like 3 years before. And I was like, God, you got to help me. And he's like, oh, you bet you're still in Florida? And I was like, no, I'm in Japan. And he started laughing. He's like, oh, could you get any further away? So I actually went to like one meeting in 1998 in Japan at the same place where I ended up going to regular meetings like 20 years later. And like, I realized so much, like I found an old journal and mm-hmm. it had the name of the church written down and like contact information. Oh, it's the same church. I was there like 20 years ago, but I, you know, had another 20 years to go. So. But I was introduced to it in the 90s anyway. So I knew where to go when I finally gave up.
And was it just, you're just finally got to the point where you're sick and tired of being sick and tired?
Things were, so again, and again, this is also in the book. It's, I lost a job at Disney after about 10 years. And then,
a long time.
Yeah, well, more like 8. And then I was literally a hermit for like 11 years. 11 years I was in a room with the shades closed. I was 100 pounds heavier. I was drinking every day. I was just on the internet. Like,
how did you not die?
Well, it was like subsistence, though. It wasn't like I wasn't drinking super heavily. It was maintenance. I would drink like 6 beers and a small whiskey mm-hmm. every day. How did I not die? It's a good question. The way I was eating, too, I was eating McDonald's every day. It's a miracle I didn't die. But the thing is, so I was really just flat for so many years. And my daughter was born in the meantime. And then somehow, for some reason, around 2016, 2017, things started to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure why. I took a trip to America and I really kind of went off the rails and I was just kind of, you know, and looking for drugs and things were getting worse. And then, I started thinking I was going to die. Like the way I was drinking, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I was like just hurting myself, falling down. And it just got worse to the point where I couldn't stand it anymore. And I was starting to get delusional too. Like The thing is, when I gave up, when I finally, so that's the thing. Like, is when I finally realized it and said, I'm an alcoholic. There's a story behind this, by the way. Actually, I'll tell you the story.
Please.
Yes. What really did it was I came out. I had always been attracted to men, attracted to women and men, but like I was always very secretive. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, same thing with bullying. You know, it was like it was a dangerous time. And I remember thinking to myself, and this was okay. So this was back when I was looking for anything to cure me, to make me feel better, except quitting drinking. I
Of
lost all the
course.
weight. I actually lost all the weight before that because I'll be happy if I look better. I did all kinds of other extreme shit. And then it was like, oh, I'm so miserable because I haven't come out. It's a lie. Everything's a lie. If I come out, I'll be happy. And so, and I, in the worst way, and I humiliated my wife and my daughter. It came out on Facebook, all dramatic. I was drunk as fuck. I wrote, you know, I can't live this way anymore, blah, 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 and all the shit. And I got all kinds of lovely, supportive responses. And so many people kept saying, oh my God, you must feel like this weight has been lifted off your shoulders. You must feel so much better. And I didn't. And I realized right then, like within the day or two, it's the fucking alcohol. That's the real shame. That's the deeper problem. That's the thing I have to fix. And I, you know, and that was the surrender. And I was so out of it at that point, I couldn't even like find like phone numbers on the computer to get to. I ended up sending a message to like AA, like home, the main office in New York City. Right. That was the only email I could find. And they sent me a phone number back in Tokyo and all that. And so that's how I ended up. But I what I was going to say before that story was I knew where to go. Having seen that stuff in the 90s, and I became a real enemy of that shit. Oh, it's a cult. Stay the fuck away from that. They're all religious nuts. Don't do that. But yeah, I knew who I had to call when I finally realized, okay, it's the alcohol. I'm an alcoholic. I'm fucked. But that wasn't my last drink. I had one more relapse in me, and that almost killed me. That was all a year later, and that was
So you
that.
got
Yeah,
sober in 2018 or 2017?
So that was 2017. In 2018, I had a 2 week really. I was
Bender.
really just trying to kill myself. I was doing a popping Xanax like candy, chewing on them, and drinking, and trying to jump in front of trains. That's all I, you know, that, and that was that. But I didn't stay away from AA is the thing. I kept going to meetings and talking on the phone. Because there's no rule that says you can't go drunk.
I did. I picked up a 9 month chip when I was fucked up.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that was that. Yeah, that, and that was 2018, September 11th, 2018.
Wow. My sobriety date's September 13th, 2008.
Wow. Coming up on 18. Nice.
So for me, it was hitting like my codependency bottom. It was through that that I really came to terms with the trauma, you know, like really realizing that like for
That's
so
a big
long
deal.
I thought alcohol was the problem, you know, and it was through that experience that I realized that, you know, they say alcohol is just a symptom, but it was through that experience that I realized that alcoholism was just a symptom of the underlying trauma. And so was that similar for you? Was your experience of with this narcissist and hitting this codependency bottom, did that experience allow you to understand like the true power of the underlying trauma?
Yes. And it also started me on the deeper work, like the inner child stuff, which I is in the Coda book. There's for double winners, I was told something by somebody that I really, really trust and respect, and I actually saw her this week. Advice that will save an alcoholic will kill a codependent. And that was very true for
So
me. So it
true.
was getting worse in some ways. And I was getting, you know, suicidal and just like I don't want to live either way. I don't want to go back to drinking. I don't want to live the way it is now. I'm not getting this wonderful, happy, every, you know.
Because you know that the, you know that the drinking won't work. You know, it's like, you know, you're going to, it won't even work.
My mind just went straight to suicide. Like, you know, it's like, don't bother with the alcohol. That's just a middleman thing. But the thing is, though, double winner means I need both. So like advice that will kill the codependent will save an alcoholic. Okay, so what do I do?
Can you speak to that more? Like, what do you, what do you think? What specifically is that advice?
You, well, if you're a double winner, you got to find the balance. Like, so for
example, I mean, like, what is the advice that to an alcoholic that would kill a codependent?
You're full of self-pity. Get out of your own head and go help someone. Is advice that will harm both people, because you'll go and try to sponsor somebody, you'll fuck it all up. They'll, you know what I mean? And like, if your own head is fucked, you trying to go help someone is only going to feed the codependency. That's maybe one example. I don't know if you think that's a good example. Or I could
absolutely. Right. And I'm also curious if you experienced this as well. Like, one of the things that I really felt a lot of shame about was like, I'm doing the steps, like I'm doing all the things, like why, like what the hell's wrong with me? Like, why does this seem to work for other people? Like, why are other people's relationships improving? Also too, I think one thing that's can be dangerous is like the whole concept of like, just asking God to remove your character defects, when like character defects are trauma responses, you know, like they're embedded in your nervous system. Like, you can't really pray them away.
Right. Well, I mean, it's, I have a different take on what that means too. Is like, is I hate the word defect anyway, but yeah, is it's old. I think old coping patterns or old, you know, things that used to work but don't work anymore, that kind of thing. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I'm trying to think. Every word that you said makes so much sense. I'm really resonating with it, and I don't really have much to add to it. I just think, yeah, it's exactly how I felt. And why isn't this working is a big part of it. And like, why are these other people getting these like really nice bonds, and I'm getting them sometimes? But then other times it's, you know, feels like I'm blowing up relationships. That goes back to the water seeks its own level thing, right? Here's the thing. I don't believe in a one-way codependent relationship.
Oh, of course.
It's a, you know, and that's the whole thing. If there's one person who's, you know, and for me, like the codependent patterns are really so interesting. I am a low bottom codependent, and I can tick off every box at times, but mainly I would go to low self-esteem and compliance, and I would slide right in with a controller, just like a glove. And the thing is, when a compliant stops complying, shit goes nuclear. And so,
yeah, just like when the scapegoat stops playing their role.
Yep, exactly.
Or any role that you play in a family, when you stop playing, it doesn't have to be, but especially like a scapegoat, totally. Right?
Well, this is the one that I'm very familiar with. Right. And that's the thing, is like at that time I was finally starting to have relationships that I cared about. I was able to sort of maintain some of them, but I would have a lot of blowups and a lot of frustration. And there was several relationships I was desperate not to lose. And I'll tell you what, sitting here today, I lost every one of those relationships. And at the time that was unthinkable to me. It was like, they're so important. I love them so much. And I did love them a lot, and they were important, but it was also very dysfunctional on both sides in every case. And it just, you know, I think it's possible to heal relationships like that if both people want to, if both people are growing. But that's the thing, when the water seeks its own level, if one person gets better or worse, that's when shit fractures. Even with my marriage, with my ex-wife, when I started healing and getting better, that's when the divorce talk started. And it was like, well, you know, there was a caretaker thing going on there. There was a, you know, he's a worthless piece of shit, but so I have to take care of him, that kind of thing going on. That stopped being true. And then things fractured. So
yeah, because when the roles that you always played, like, I think that that's like the biggest thing that, and even in relationships that maybe are not like, you wouldn't necessarily deem them to be like super, super toxic. You know, I think when people start healing, even in relationships that seem like they're, you know, I won't say like pillars of health, but, you know, like decently, you know, healthy or just not a total shit show. It's just, it's that shift in the roles and the relationship not being able to pivot to that.
Yep. Sorry. I'm like, I'm just absorbing your words. It's like some of the, it's really cool to be on the same wavelength.
Yeah. No, I get it. So one thing that I think is really interesting is, you know, talking about this, this relationship that you had with, it was like a spiritual leader, right? They had
of
the
a sort.
Yeah.
Of a sort.
Yeah. Of a sort. Yeah. I mean,
it was
a fraud.
Something of it. Well, it was a bit cultish.
Yes.
I'll say that. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say that something that I've been thinking about, I think as scapegoats, like we tend to, and this speaks to what we were just talking about relationships not being able to pivot to that, like, or both people have to be willing to have a relationship work. Like, I feel like for me, I've had a lot of relationships where I think that we tend to attract relationships where the other person is completely unable to take any sort of personal accountability. I've attracted a lot of relationships with people where that has been the breaking point, has been the other person being completely unwilling to take accountability. And then often, like, I'm curious if this is what happened in your circumstances, like the lashing out that comes from shining a light on that, right? I think that the shame that brings up in somebody else, you know, will really cause them to lash out.
Absolutely. And so a few things on that. Totally agree with everything you just said. The falling out was around the fact that I challenged this person's toxic positivity. That's what I was, you know, that was against the rules. And I was just starting to get an understanding of what toxic positivity was and how destructive it was for me. The thing is, now this person, and there was another person too, and these two people, I would say, are the only ones who I was outright discarded by, like the whole shunning thing, the whole like you're out of the circle, I'm not gonna speak to you anymore. Both of them said that they were not at all 0% codependent. In fact, the one person who caused the re-traumatization told me that he is impossible to have a codependent relationship with. And that's why I'm getting so spun out. Right? And those two people are some of a couple of the most codependent people I've ever met.
Well, I think that they probably genuinely believe that, though. I mean, it's, you know. Yeah.
So that's why I think it's borderline narcissist or really narcissist. Because if you can't sit there and say, maybe some of this has to do with me. I mean, Jesus, all I did, and I'm sure most of us just go, what did I do? I must have had some role in this. Most people do that, except narcissists, right? Where they just go,
well, I don't know. I think to an extent, but like, I think that, I don't know if I would deem them all to be narcissistic tendencies, sure. But I think that shame causes us to do one of two things, right? Like, we either, for those of us who were, for a lot of adult children of dysfunctional families, it's like, and I just did a like a little workshop with this in my community. I mean, it's one of two things. It's either like you are overly accountable, like you take responsibility for, you think everything's your fault, right? Like that. But the shame goes the opposite way too, where the defenses that are built up, like, it will prevent you from being able to see any of that. So I think it's trauma. I think it's childhood shame that blocks people from being able to go there at all.
Oh, sure.
You know, but there's something so painful about it too. And I don't know if you like can relate to this, and it's not personal, like these people not being willing to take accountability, you know, but I have a part of me, you know, that has felt like, you know, like I'm not worth it. You know what I mean? Like I'm not worth taking accountability for, I'm not worth facing themselves in order to like salvage a relationship. You know, like there's a part of me, you know, like a wounded inner child that's like, you know, I'm not worth it.
But you know, that's not true, right?
No. Yeah. 100%. You know, but there's a part of me that feels that way at times, you know? So,
I never thought about that in words, but I certainly felt like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why, you know, why isn't this relationship important?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
why am I not worth fighting for?
Yeah. Sure.
So that's okay. So it came from you challenging that, and then it was just lashed out and discarded.
Yeah. And, but it's funny thinking about it because it took years to get over it. Mm-hmm. And,
when was that?
That was my Coda bottom.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
I want to say it's been, okay. So November 2021, I think.
That's pretty good. I mean, to get to that in 3 years, I would say that for a lot of like recovering alcoholics, like that shit usually happens between 5 to 10 years. So nice that you only had to wait 3 years.
Yeah, I was on the fast track because I was going to put a bullet in my head if I didn't.
Yes.
It was like I had to figure it out or give up. Mm-hmm. Because I went through a lifetime of thinking I was unlikable and unlovable.
Mm-hmm.
And I was tired of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if I'm genuinely unlikable and unlovable, I really believe that about myself. If that's true, I don't want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to find a solution. So I think that, you know, so the thing about that is you asking about the date. So yeah, about coming up on whatever, 21, 2, 3, 4, 5, coming up on 5 years. And it was just complete pain for a year. And just, I really wanted it. So I joined Codependence Anonymous. That was another thing that I was, resisting for a while until the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I joined Codependence Anonymous 2 days before the discard.
Mm.
I had already found a Codependence Anonymous sponsor and I told him about the discard. He was like, really? It might have been a factor in the discard.
Did they know?
But anyway, yes.
You know what's interesting I want to ask you about this is like, there was something about you that was either started to heal or something that was the ability that you had and the willingness that you had to even speak up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it was.
But what do you think that, I mean, cause like there's something there that obviously you were starting to shift and heal to a certain extent if you were willing to call it out.
Right. And that, I mean, that was a part of the, I think the realization that the roles were shifting,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I don't want to get too much into that thinking about the specifics because the relationship had been fracturing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of trying to just hang on to it. So it's in a way, in a really weird way, I look back at it and I think I'm the one who triggered the discard.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had been thinking about like, you know, I can't go on like this
mm-hmm.
and like, I'm going to have to end the, you know, end our friendship or whatever, this or that, it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be normal enough for it to be okay. I was, you know, very blaming myself and he's a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
But, at the end, like I'm very good at triggering people. This is a talent. I was talking to a psychologist one time, and she said that. She's like, you really know how to push people's buttons when you want to. I was like, and so I knew exactly, to call him on his toxic positivity in public. Another part of it. That's like, and it was completely legitimate. It was a fair opinion. I didn't say anything unkind or you know what I mean? On paper, he couldn't get away with, I should have been able to get away with it. And even people were saying, well, what the hell was wrong with him? You didn't say anything wrong, but I knew that that's what would do it. And I think not consciously, but subconsciously. And when I look back at that, that relationship was the biggest favor because it just allowed me to see the whole thing, but it still, still broke it broke my heart. I still to this day think if that person, and I went no contact, by the way. This a few months later, I had to go no contact because I couldn't keep things casual without that person acknowledging their side of things. And it's like, and just for my own mental health,
Yeah, it
like
feels
just
like
like,
betraying yourself.
hey, how's it going? I went skiing this weekend. Was I couldn't stand it, and I still can't. I still, to this day, would not want to rekindle any kind of relationship unless he, saw his side of things and wanted to have a real healing conversation. But I don't see that happening. But either way, it's not the no contact thing. I'm not a guy who does no contact. It's not my thing. I don't really believe, some people are just like, I'm no contact with five people because of this and that. It's not my thing, but just for my own stability and mental health, I did that. And I think I needed to do that. And it's not like, a punishment or feeling that like, but that person is able to still harm me even to this day. Because if they walked in and started with that shit again, it would affect me physiologically, emotionally. I'd get over it, I'd figure it out, I'd do the work, but it would definitely affect me.
100%. So, what has repairing the relationship with your daughter looked like?
Amazing. That's the blessings of recovery. Absolutely. She's my step one. She's my step one because the morning of my sobriety date, I saw her in the house and I said, oh, I had no memory of the shit that had gone on the day before. And I said, yeah, well, good morning. How are you? And she said, Dad, you were horrible last night. And she was 14 years old. And I looked at this beautiful girl and I thought, how can I make her understand that it's that I can't do it? It's not, I want to, I would like to, I have to make her understand. Why doesn't she understand that I can't quit? And then I was like, okay, can't, that's powerlessness. I can't do it for this reason. That's insane. I didn't see it as step one at the time, but when I look back at it, that was step one. And she really hated me. She couldn't even stand the sight of me for good reason for a couple of years. She didn't want to be in the same room with me. And I don't blame her. And I started doing the work, and I did the best I could. And she worked hard too. I think, so the Thanksgiving after, so like about a year and change after I got sober, we spent Thanksgiving together with some friends at a farmhouse. And it was the first time she was willing to do anything with me. It was like a good 15, 16 months later. And it was tense, and there was a lot of arguments and whatnot, but she was willing to try spending a little time with me. And then like a couple of years after that, we took a trip together and it was like cats and dogs. We were fighting the whole trip. Now she's my favorite tra she's always been my favorite travel buddy, but now I think I'm her one of her favorite
Mutual.
travel. Yeah, we traveled together. She came to Thailand and spent the new year with me in Chiang Mai, and now I'm back. She's nearby here in Tokyo. Here in Chiba, and our relationship's beautiful. It really is. And since her mom and I have separated and divorced, I was afraid the relationship would fall away but it's actually gotten stronger. You know, it was, she trusts me, and for good reason. She can trust me. She knows she can trust me. I provide good advice when she needs it or wants it, but I don't just try to interfere in her life. She's, by the way, she just turned 22. So she's not a kid. Mm-hmm. She's a young woman, and I'm super proud of her. She's awesome. And yeah, so that's been the most miraculous thing about recovery. Absolutely.
Has she read your book?
But I don't think she reads any books, to be honest with you. She doesn't read. The one book I really wanted her to read, and I'd like her to read my book too, but the one book I would really want her to read is the ACA book, because I bought that big red ACA mm-hmm. book. Cost me yep. a lot of money in Japanese, because her first language is Japanese. Neither she nor her mother have ever cracked it open. Mm-hmm. So it's there if they want to, but I remind her every now and again. And, you know, we've talked about that, like the trauma of being an adult child and what that's like, mm-hmm. and that there's help out there, and she doesn't want it just yet, but you know, if she wants it, she knows where to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Send her my way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, your story is like quite remarkable, and good Lord, the trauma. I mean, it's a ton of trauma.
It is. It really is. And I've been blessed and lucky recently. There hasn't been any big, you know, but I have had a lot of grieving recently.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you what's been present for you lately.
Yeah. And I've been grieving. I got divorced in November. Late 2024. I left Japan on New Year's Eve, 2024, and left that house as well, and was traveling in Southeast Asia, really beautiful places, but I was thinking, like, you know, why am I not enjoying this more, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. But I was grieving. I look back and it should have been obvious, but it wasn't. I was mm-hmm. grieving all that, my life in Japan. And then my dad passed away. That was in December of last year. Mm-hmm. And so that brought up a whole other, as you can imagine, you know, mm-hmm. mixed
was there
emotions.
Anything that you came to terms with that perhaps you weren't able to while he was still alive that came
a
up
lot.
For you after he passed? Yeah.
A lot, because I was always afraid of him as long as he was alive. And mm-hmm. so that was kind of keeping. So I was always a little bit, you know, he always had the ability similar to this, the narcissist we've talked about. Mm-hmm. He always had the ability to, you know, to hurt emotionally, but maybe not even intentionally, but, you know, mm-hmm. father, right? Such a powerful figure. So after he passed away, I started remembering a lot of happy memories that I had not been able to access mm-hmm. because I'd always been sort of, you know, boundaries. There was always mm-hmm. the boundaries there. And I always loved him. But as I said, we talked a couple of days before he passed away. He passed away suddenly. And I'm glad that I got the chance to talk to him. And I did a lot of work to repair that relationship. And he did the best he could for somebody not in recovery and whatnot. A lot since that point. You know, I realized that I loved him, like clearly. I realized, and you know, there's a lot of like benefit of the doubt stuff. Like I know in many of those cases, he was doing the best he could with the tools that he had. And he was super defensive. Like he was, even when I was a kid, and this was we went to a family therapist.
When you were a kid?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to all of you together. I just got sent to by myself.
That too. Well, I had both. Mm-hmm. But the family therapy was when we would accuse him of whatever, his answer was, well, if you don't like me, get out of my life.
What age was this?
Yeah.
This is when you were like a kid?
10 or 12.
Yeah. Okay. That's great.
and as an adult as well. He's like, well, if you don't like what I'm saying, well, just fuck off. You know, that was his, but that was, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I would have said, especially deep into the alcohol when like everybody, hey, you're being an obnoxious asshole. What's wrong with you? It's like, well, if you don't like me, fuck off, you know? Cause like I had no other, you know, mm-hmm. cause he wanted forgiveness. He wanted like some kind of something. And so I understood it. I think I understood it. Maybe more than my sister. My sister was also very hurt by him. But she's also, she's what I might call a normie.
There's no way. There's no way.
She's not an alcoholic anyway, but
yeah, so she's like, she's definitely been impacted.
Oh, for sure impacted. Yeah. But the thing, but the understanding of how you can get so low, I think she didn't see that. She just thought But for me, the really humbling realization in the middle of things was that I did things to my daughter that were as bad or worse, you know, but thankfully there was a chance to start healing that stuff. And for him and me too, you know, because of recovery, even though he didn't find it, you know, it sort of, it starts to have an impact either way. But I'll say one thing that was, again, on the AA side, I was sort of encouraged or ordered to make amends with my family of origin that never really should have happened. And on the contrary, they really should have been doing that for me. But it was okay. It worked out okay. But I think sometimes, you know, and that's, you know, how that can be in 12 step. You get a lot of, you know, the commander subordinate thing, controller and compliant thing. And people, I've seen people like, oh, I just made amends to my family who were so abusive to me. And I had to say, sorry, why is, you know, so, but anyway, it's okay that that happened, but it was kind of weird.
Yeah. But I mean, but for some people it could be really quite damaging and traumatizing, re-traumatizing. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. So what does recovery look like for you today?
Peace of mind. And so I had, so I'm very spiritual. I pray a lot. I don't really bring that into my writing work too much or talk about it all that much outwardly, but I definitely rely on God and that's what gets me through the day. And that's what I learned from, recovery work, 12-step work. I didn't go to a lot of meetings. And this is something I would have been ashamed to say and afraid to say, especially not on live TV or whatever. A few years ago, oh my God, you didn't go to a lot of meetings. I didn't go to a lot of meetings in my travels. It depended on if I connected. When I was in Vietnam, I found really good community in Da Nang. So I was going to a lot of meetings in Da Nang, but it was mostly social. It was mostly just, you know, it's great when you're in recovery or in AA, you have a built-in set of friends in a city. But other times I went months without meetings, but I was always connected with people that I trust. I know that there are people that I can connect with, and like Coda, I can do like sharing. I can get advice if I think that I need it, but generally I go to prayer for advice. I don't particularly, I know where my integrity is. And this is also what recovery looks like for me, is like I found what my integrity is. And so I know when I'm going against it. I know when I'm like, you know, in on the borderline. And I also, I'm not perfect. It depends on the day. I had a lot of temptation in Thailand because all the drugs and shit going on there. And it's like, my brain was just like, well, why don't you go get high? It's, you know, and I never did. But that's not to say that I couldn't have. And I did reach out to people and say, hey, man, I'm feeling like this, and people that I trust. And they were like, yeah, it does sound like you might be in a little bit of trouble, you know? So, yeah, that's what it looks like for me. What about you?
Well, I have therapy after this. So I do, are you familiar with IFS?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So I do IFS therapy and, I have my community. So I started my community a couple years ago, and it's called The Shit Show because I call myself a recovering shit show. And for me, I realized a couple years ago, like when I, you know, I kind of had another dark night of the soul. So I started doing this work in 2018. But for me, it was like I hadn't done any of the body stuff. You know, like the body really does keep the score, like that, you know, trauma really does live in your body. And so it's been a lot of like, it's been a lot of somatic work, you know, as of late. So it's like a lot of breath work and, I just continue. I mean, this shit is never ending. Like the peeling.
There's always a new layer, right? Peel the next layer, right?
Yeah.
I did a really cool somatic thing in Thailand on Koh Phangan, which is like this, you know, super groovy, you know, woo woo island. Right. And I went to this seminar. It was pretty cool. And then the guy met me and he said, what did he say? Oh, you have a lot of grief. And that's what he said. You have a lot of grief. And I could see it in your neck or something. Mm. What? Grief? But it's now I'm just remembering that. And I sort of brushed it off at the time.
It's there. It's, I used to think like, you know, the somatic aspect of it was like beneficial. Mm. It's a requirement. And I mean, that's also what healing looks like for me too, is like the body stuff. Like I have disc degeneration in my neck. So like my hips all screwed up. And so that's part of that too, is like trying to figure out how to fix my body.
Right.
So. Mm. Yep. Well, I loved this. This was great, David. And we'll put your the links to all your to Wounded Angel in the show notes. And then we'll have to have you back on when you come out with your next one.
Absolutely. That sounds great. Thank you.